Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com. This show is supported by State Farm. You have insurance for your home, your health, and your car. Why don't you have insurance for your small business? So many small business owners think they don't need or don't even know about small business insurance. Protecting a source of revenue is one thing, but so is protecting all of your hard work and your team members. State Farm agents are all small business owners too, so they know how to help small business owners choose personalized policies that fit their budgets. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
From the High Center Studios of the recipient of so much of my tuition money, Messiah College in Grantham, Pennsylvania, this is the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast, a biweekly discussion dedicated to American history, historical thinking, and the role of history in our everyday lives. And now, here's your host, author and award-winning historian, John Fia.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 23 of the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast. It is good to have you with us. Okay, Drew. We're going to do something a little bit different on today's show.
All right.
We are going to start off with a quiz.
The pop quiz from the prof.
Pop quiz. You thought you were done with pop quizzes from me.
I give them now.
15 years ago. Right. Now you give them. But I'm going to grill you with some questions about what you do with your money. And I'll try to jump in and answer some of these as well. Did you do, a few years ago when this was all the rage, did you do the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge?
No, I did not.
You did not?
I did not. Did you?
I did not do it, although both my daughters did. They tried to get me to do it, but I wimped out because I didn't want ice cold water dumped on my head. Okay, so two no's there.
Okay.
Have you ever bought a box of Girl Scout cookies?
Absolutely.
What is your favorite?
I'll go with Thin Mints and throw them in the freezer.
I like the Samoas. How about you, Josh? Thin Mints. Josh checks in from behind the glass. Thin Mints, yeah. I like the Samoas. I could eat a whole box at one time. Anyway, okay. By the way, too, we have one of my former students, Katie Garland, who's a great public historian, actually works as a development officer at the Girl Scouts.
Oh, okay.
Throw that in case. Shout out to Katie in case she's listening. Okay. Have you ever supported a student taking a missions trip or some other kind of service trip, whether in the United States or abroad?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, I do that all the time. Yeah. In fact, both of my daughters are raising money for trips right now.
So. And I should add, I have received donations to do that kind of work
me
as
too.
Well.
You know, me so too.
It's come both ways.
Excellent. Okay, next question. Have you ever bought a raffle ticket at a high school event, like a sporting event, or I don't know if they do them at plays or something, but, you know, have you ever done that?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, I did. When my daughters played sports, I bought one every week. Actually, I won like $68 once on a raffle at my daughter's volleyball game. Have you ever given clothes to Goodwill or Community Aid or Salvation Army or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you know, that's a regular conversation. As my wife notes, all of the clothes in my closet that I haven't worn in a couple years, asking me why they're still in the closet. And so I
get that
filter through, and yeah,
I get that all the time. And my answer usually is, well, I'm going to lose like 20 pounds, so then they'll fit me. So I don't want to get rid of them yet.
Same thing.
So
obviously, I'm going to be the exact same size I was as a high school student.
And I've given my money to Goodwill. I buy a lot of my clothes at Goodwill.
Yep.
It was a habit I began in graduate school and just continue to this day. Okay, have you ever dropped change into the pot of a Salvation Army Santa Claus?
Yep. Yeah, I try to. I mean, although it's harder now because I carry change so much less than I used to,
exactly.
Right? I mean, I pay with credit card, and actually, I'm really excited. I just started using the Apple Pay on my iPhone, so I just wave my phone at the grocery store now. And so I don't, you know, they're often, those Santa Clauses are often outside of grocery stores, and I don't have change in my pocket to give, so I almost feel bad. I wish they had, like, a card swipe.
They should get, that's a good idea if you're listening there from the Salvation Army. There's a tip. Now, this is going to be a local Pennsylvania question, and I know you're from Pennsylvania, and I've lived here for about 15 years, so were you ever involved in the Pennsylvania Thon when you were in school?
Right, yeah, that's associated with Penn State University, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Penn State.
Yeah. No, I've never been involved with that one, although I know plenty of people
who are. It's a fascinating program that Penn State does. It's an all-night dance marathon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not only do they do it at Penn State, but they do it, local high schools have their mini-thon. My daughters do it at their high school. You know, they stay up all night, and it's not only dancing, but they have, you know, other events too. Mm-hmm. You know, like dodgeball and.
Well, you know, and it's the largest college charity event in the country, I think.
And it raises money for.
I know it's cancer research.
Cancer research. Yeah. That's right. Okay, one more question: have you ever given money to your alma mater? We already know that from the opening, but
well, that's the. I think I was more referring to the tuition dollars, but actually, yeah, you know, I and maybe this is a shout out to the alumni giving organization here at Messiah College. I think they do a really good job. You know, so often those alumni organizations call you up and ask for big bucks, and well, I don't have the big bucks to give, but you know, Messiah does a good job, and they have very specific things that they're trying to raise money for, and so. Actually, you know, my nephew's a student here, and I remember last year they were asking for very small donations for care packages for first year students during their first finals week.
Okay.
I think was what it was. So yeah, of course, yeah, I'd give money and just assume it's going to my nephew.
Well, you're probably wondering why we're asking all of these questions
today. That's a long introduction.
Some of you maybe have already figured this out. Well, if you haven't guessed, we're going to be spending this episode of the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast talking about giving in America. And as usual, we're going to tackle this issue historically from the perspective of the fields of the history of philanthropy and charity.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I'm kind of thinking about now that some of these questions that you chose for this mini pop quiz, and one of the things I've tried to develop, not really so much a young adult, but as a early in adulthood here, is to be really mindful about where I give my money. I've come to realize, and part of this has to do with some of the work I've done and the work my wife has done, that not every charity is created equal. Some charities, unfortunately, don't do nearly as much good as others. So I do try to be really mindful about where I'm giving my money and where I'm not giving my money.
Yeah.
And part of that, I think, has to be a historical question. It comes from delving into the history of philanthropy. And once again, like so many of our episodes, I think that this history has the potential to make a big impact.
Yeah, it's just you don't even think about that. We give, whether it be money or time and so forth, and you don't really think of that as a historical kind of something you historicize, but it's such a day-to-day part of our lives, you know, in terms of charity and giving and philanthropy and so forth. I just recently learned about this entire field of the history of philanthropy. As some of you know, I wrote this book on the history of the American Bible Society. And, you know, I wrote it as an early 19th century historian, at least the initial chapters, as an American religious historian. But the book really seemed to resonate with the people in this history of philanthropy community. And I never really thought even of framing the book that way. But our guide for this journey through giving in America, or the history of giving in America, will be Amanda Moniz. She is the David M. Rubenstein Curator of Philanthropy at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. She's written a lot about the history of philanthropy. She just started there as the Curator of Philanthropy. And we're really excited to talk to her today. But before we do that, speaking of giving and charity and philanthropy and poor podcasters, Drew, let's take care of some business here before we move on.
Well, as always, we are able to bring you this podcast through the generous donations of Lisa DeGuardi and Ron Schooler, as well as our sponsor, Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. And unlike public radio, we never take a break from fundraising. Although we do try to keep our pitch a bit shorter than our NPR counterparts. And, you know, it's always hard when you tune in for the news and you're hearing them fundraising. But now that I'm on the other end of that, it's an important part of the equation. But that does mean you can still become one of our sponsors. I have mugs in the closet of my study just waiting to be mailed. So if you want to either give us a monthly pledge of support or make a flat donation, just head over to thewayofimprovement.com and click support.
We have mugs. We have books.
Books.
We have even higher order gifts where you get your name announced on the program to our millions of listeners.
Millions.
Right? So get over to the site, click on support. Help us out here. We're so appreciative for those of you who already have. Thank you so much. Again, I'll say this, I've said it 100 times now, but we always need good American history, but we need it even more in times of great social and political change. So please do what you can to help us keep this thing going here at The Way of Improvement Leads Home.
So before we get and unpack this fascinating conversation about giving and about philanthropy, I do believe you have a story to start us off, John.
I recently had the chance to teach Andrew Carnegie's famous 1889 North Atlantic Review essay titled simply, Wealth. As an early American historian by training, I do not get too many opportunities to teach post-Civil War United States history. But a new course I developed on Pennsylvania history has provided a rare opportunity to dip into some of the ideas that drove the Keystone State and, by extension, the nation's industrial history. Many of you know the name Andrew Carnegie. The Scottish-born Pennsylvania steel magnate worked his way up from a bobbin boy in a western Pennsylvania cotton factory to one of the two or three wealthiest men in America. In addition to his work as a robber baron, or captain of industry, I guess it all depends on your perspective, Carnegie prided himself as a writer and a philosopher of industrial age America. He is perhaps best known for his so-called Gospel of Wealth essays, in which he argued that millionaires had the responsibility to give away their fortunes before they died. His North Atlantic Review essay was his first public exploration into this idea. Much of Carnegie's essay is informed by the teachings of Herbert Spencer, the man behind the theory of social Darwinism and the first to use the term survival of the fittest. Under Spencer's system, Carnegie was one of the survivors, a man with unusual talents that enabled him to rise above the rabble and obtain massive amounts of wealth. And with great wealth comes great responsibility, the responsibility to advance civilization, as he put it. For Carnegie, social inequality was inevitable. Quote, the contrast between the palace of the millionaire and the cottage of the laborer has come with civilization, unquote. This change, Carnegie wrote, is not to be deplored, but welcomed. It is highly beneficial, Carnegie said, if not essential, for the progress of the race. Carnegie believed that the houses of some should be homes for all that is highest and best in literature and arts, and for all the refinements of civilization, rather than that none should be so. Or to put it differently, Carnegie added, much better this great irregularity in the social structure than universal squalor. At one level, inequality was good for Carnegie because it allowed the advancement of civilization as he understood it. This was clear from the way he described the transition from the small-scale home manufacturing of the pre-Civil War era to the post-war era of industrial manufacturing. Carnegie said, formerly, articles were manufactured at the domestic hearth in small shops which formed part of the household. The master and his apprentices worked side by side, the latter living with the master and therefore subject to the same conditions. When these apprentices rose to be master, there was little or no change in their mode of life, and they, in turn, educated in the same routine succeeded by the apprentices. There was substantial social equality. But Carnegie thought Americans could do better than this master-apprentice system. He wrote that, quote, "The inevitable result of such a mode of manufacture was crude articles at high prices. Today, the world obtains commodities of excellent quality at prices which even the generation preceding this would have found incredible," unquote. For Carnegie, the trade-off was a no-brainer. Social equality was no match for quality goods at what today we might call everyday low prices. In this sense, capitalists like Carnegie appear to know more about the nature and passions of human beings than all the theologians and philosophers combined. He was making a bet that the desire for such goods among ordinary Americans would always trump their desire to fight for such social equality. As Bernie Sanders has recently reminded us, this is a bet that all capitalists make. And if history is any indication, it is a bet that they often win. But all of this does not mean that Carnegie does not care about the plight of those who Herbert Spencer might describe as the unfit or less fit. This is where Carnegie's commitment to philanthropy enters the essay. He writes, "There remains then only one mode of using great fortunes. But in this we have the true antidote for the temporary unequal distribution of wealth, the reconciliation of the rich and poor, a reign of harmony. This is another ideal, differing indeed from that of the communists in requiring only the further evolution of existing conditions, not the total overthrow of our civilization. Under its sway, we have an ideal state in which the surplus wealth of the few will become in the best sense the property of the many. Because administered for the common good, this wealth, passing through the hands of a few, can be made a much more potent force for the elevation of our race than if it had been distributed in small sums to the people themselves." In Carnegie's view, the wealthy have a responsibility to fix the problem of social inequality and the unequal distribution of wealth through philanthropy. By donating money to the building of libraries and schools, Carnegie believes that he can, quote-unquote, elevate the race and bring about a new world order. The capitalist, this is the man who has survived through his superior talents, needs to accumulate more and more wealth so that he can distribute it in the way he sees fit. Unlike the communists, or even the socialists, or advocates of some other form of big government committed to welfare programs, the capitalist is best suited for reconciling the rich and the poor and ushering in what Carnegie calls his reign of harmony. The goal of the capitalist was to accumulate as much wealth as possible, live frugally, and give it all away to help the community. In the 1880s, Carnegie's steel business increased its production by over 800%. As historian Jackson Lears has written, much of this was squeezed directly out of the workers by keeping wages low, hours long, breaks infrequent, and the threat of layoffs constant, unquote. This should not surprise us. A more humane approach to workers would have gotten in the way of Carnegie's philanthropic efforts.
This show is supported by State Farm. Insurance is a part of any solid financial plan. Making sure you have the important things in life covered is one of the best ways to give yourself a little breathing room when things go awry. It's important to protect not only your business, but yourself as a business owner and all current and future team members. State Farm agents know what it takes to run and protect a small business because State Farm agents are all small business owners and they live and work in your community. So they're deeply attuned to what's happening with other small businesses in your market. If you have a small business and are interested in making sure you're protected, reach out to your local State Farm agent to learn more about what you need. They'll help you find the right policy at the right price for your business. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Thanks, John. Our guest today is Amanda Muniz, the David M. Rubenstein Curator of Philanthropy at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. Amanda received her PhD from the University of Michigan in 2008 and held a Cassius Marcellus Clay postdoctoral fellowship at Yale University from 2008 to 2010. Prior to joining the staff of the Smithsonian, she was the assistant director of the National History Center in Washington, D.C. A scholar of American humanitarianism in the Revolutionary Era, Dr. Moniz has received numerous grants and fellowships, including those from the Social Science Research Council and the Library Company of Philadelphia's Program on Early American Economy and Society. She is the author of From Empire to Humanity, The American Revolution and the Origins of Humanitarianism, which was published in 2016, with Oxford University Press.
We are thrilled today on the podcast to have Amanda Muniz with us. Amanda is a scholar of American humanitarianism and philanthropy, and she is currently the curator of philanthropy, the David M. Rubenstein Curator of Philanthropy at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. Amanda, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Now, you are a historian and a public historian, a museum curator in the history of philanthropy. When people think about the subfields in American history, you know, we tend to think traditionally, right? Revolutionary era, 20th century. But most people don't naturally think about the history of philanthropy as a kind of subfield of study. Tell us about this field. You know, what do historians of philanthropy study? You know, maybe some of our listeners maybe even need a definition of kind of what philanthropy is, right? So what is it? Tell us a little bit more about this field that you work in.
I'd be happy to. And I think you're absolutely right. The history of philanthropy is relatively unknown by the general public, and it's relatively understudied by historians. I find that surprising because giving is a defining American tradition, and most people have their own or their family's involvement in the history of, they have stories of their own or their family's involvement in the history of American philanthropy. So it is surprising it's not better known. But first, let me say something about the word philanthropy.
Yeah.
Nowadays, we often think of philanthropy as meaning gifts of enormous amounts of money. That has not always been the definition of the word. In the 18th century, the period I study, when people used the word philanthropy, they used it to refer to a sentiment. Philanthropy in the original Greek means love of mankind or love of humanity, and people used it in that broad way to refer to their feelings, and those feelings could motivate activity, it could motivate gifts of money, gifts of time. So a philanthropist could be somebody who was involved in the anti-slavery movement or in prison reform or somebody who was in active in medical charities. And I, when I use the word, I use it in that broad way to refer to how people give their time and talent and money to causes to advance the public good. But so you asked what we study, what do historians of philanthropy study?
Yeah.
I think of philanthropy as being the story of people mobilizing resources to support causes and institutions in hopes of having an impact. Mm-hmm. We study those four areas. The people involved in philanthropic causes, including leaders who set agendas, the managers of philanthropic organizations, donors and volunteers, the staff and the clients of organizations. We also study how resources are mobilized, how have fundraising techniques changed over time, for instance, who volunteers their time, you know, like women volunteer in the early republic, women volunteered before or after they had children or after their children were grown, usually not when they have young children, for instance. We study the many different kinds of causes people have supported, you know, everything from anti-slavery, medical philanthropy, religious missions, poor relief, education, the environment, arts and culture, and more. You know, our history is so rich with all these different movements. And finally, we study the impact of giving, although that's the least well-studied area and I think the hardest to get at.
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be, you know, I think when I think of philanthropy, right, I think about some big foundation or, you know, Andrew Carnegie or, you know, somebody like that.
Right.
But it sounds like much like other fields in American history, right, I'm almost sensing a kind of sort of social history, right, of philanthropy. You know, the sort of everyday life of giving, you know, the people and the sense of, again, this sense of sentiment or affection and so forth seems to really broaden the field a lot more. I mean, I was very surprised when, you know, people like you and others, when my book on the American Bible Society came out, mm-hmm. you know, there was this community of the historians of philanthropy who were really interested in it. And I really hadn't framed the book that way, but the more I kind of read up on what the kind of work that historians and philanthropists are doing, the more I thought, yeah, this does kind of fit.
Yeah, your book is absolutely a marvelous contribution to understanding that the history of giving in the 19th century, you know, throughout American history. I'm particularly interested in the 19th
yeah.
century. You know, the American Bible Society was just at the forefront of so many yeah. developments in mobilizing resources and disseminating information that absolutely, for me, it's a central organization in the history of philanthropy.
Yeah, really interesting. Let's we'll get back to the philanthropy here in a second, because I want to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, how the museum, the Museum of American History, handles this subject. But you are your title is Curator of Philanthropy at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. For those of our listeners who are not involved in the museum field or unfamiliar with how museums are organized and the kind of staff that work in museums, what is a curator? What do you do? What is your day-to-day experience like as a curator at a museum like this?
Right. So a curator collects, preserves, studies, and makes accessible objects in a museum or a similar type of institution like a historic home. So our work really boils down to collecting, learning, and sharing. In my case, as the curator of our National History Museum, I'm responsible for collecting objects that tell the story of American giving from the colonial era to today. And what's really exciting for me is that this is a new collecting initiative for the museum. We don't often add new collecting areas. Now, the museum, of course, has many objects already in the collection that relate to the history of philanthropy or giving in some way, but they haven't, these are objects that have not necessarily been collected or understood as being about the history of philanthropy. So what I'm doing is building a collection to tell the story of American philanthropy from the beginning to up to contemporary developments. And that means first getting a sense of what we already hold and then thinking about what else I can collect to further contextualize existing holdings and what the gaps are and what the important contemporary developments are that future historians will want to study. And so in addition, a curator exhibits objects. We put together exhibitions. We write for the blog. We do traditional scholarly work to share our work with different audiences. We talk with people to share what we're learning and to help gather ideas.
That sounds like fun, actually.
It's a great job.
Yeah. So you do get a chance, you know, I know you're a scholar of this field. You do get a chance to kind of, continue your scholarly work as well, much like you would as a, you know, as a kind of, academic, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yes.
Drew, you had a question.
Yeah, well, I mean, you mentioned just collecting these objects for the purpose of, you know, telling the story of the history of philanthropy. And I was just wondering if you could maybe highlight a few of them and kind of give a sales pitch to our listeners about the things, if they are interested in this history of philanthropy, you know, what might they actually see if they go to the National Museum?
Or they may be interested in history of philanthropy and they don't even realize it yet.
Yeah, absolutely,
right.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Well, first I should say we have an exhibition called Giving in America, which opened in December, and it's the first exhibition here on the history of philanthropy. It's organized around four questions. Who gives? Why do we give? What do we give? And how do we give? And that is a permanent, a long-term exhibition. And then there's also a rotating section of that exhibition that looks at our a yearly, each year we focus on a particular area of giving. So the rotating section explores that. This year it's giving in the environment, and next year it'll be culture and the art. And if your listeners are interested, they could come check that out in person or online. It's also available online. And what would you see in it? So
yeah.
The exhibition covers the colonial era to today. And a couple of the things that I really like in it are, one is the original mop bucket used in the ALS ice bucket challenge that was so big in the summer of 2014. So Jeanette Sinertia, who was the first person to do the ice bucket challenge for ALS because her husband Anthony has ALS, donated the bucket that she used, and it's on display there. And it's right next to a small collection box, what you might call an alms box, from the early to the mid 19th century. And what's interesting about the alms box is, I think when you look at the exhibition and you see the mop bucket, you think, I know that that's just an ordinary mop bucket, but what made it so effective was social media. It was the use of the innovative technology. Well, the alms box, though you might not think of it this way, was an innovation and a technology in its own day, too. In the 18th century, when Benjamin Franklin and his colleagues opened the Pennsylvania Hospital as a public-private partnership in Philadelphia, they got money from the state, from the colony, and they got some private money, but they also needed to do more fundraising. So they put collection boxes around Philadelphia. And what Franklin found is it wasn't effective because Americans really weren't familiar with it. And they weren't familiar with dropping money into those boxes. That remained true into the 19th century. And it's not until the 19th century, when this box is from, that using these kind of boxes becomes familiar in some communities. And I think it's the influence of religious philanthropic organizations like the Tract Societies and the Missionary Societies and the Sunday Schools that help familiarize Americans with it, because they would have the organizations distribute them in local communities to raise funds. And then what was important is that in their promotional literature, the Sunday School Union or the other organizations would explain to people how to use them.
Yeah.
So it's again a story of the use of communication technologies and a sort of ordinary object to raise awareness or raise money for a cause.
Let's talk a little bit, Amanda, about some of your own work, your own scholarship in this area. You've written a very important book in the history of philanthropy, and I would add in the history of the American Revolution. The title, again, is From Empire to Humanity, The American Revolution and the Origins of Humanitarianism. For those of our listeners who would be curious about the history of philanthropy and its relationship to the American Revolution, maybe you can explain the connections between those two kind of themes in your subtitle.
I'd be happy to. In the book, I argue that Americans and Britons embraced a universal approach in philanthropy as they became foreigners to one another in the wake of the American Revolution. So the book follows a generation of American and British philanthropists who'd been born a few decades before the American Revolution. It's a story of their lives.
Right.
Growing up before the revolutionary crisis, these men had shared an imperial approach to charitable activity, and they belonged to a transatlantic community, and they collaborated in a lot of causes across the Atlantic based on a shared concern to strengthen the British Empire. So there were missionary organizations, educational charities, and other causes. Well, the revolution, of course, fractured their community. They could no longer collaborate on the basis of a shared British identity. Right. And but they continued, these men had grown up in this strong transatlantic community, and they expected to continue collaborating. So they needed to adjust the nature of their philanthropy and also the nature of their relationships as they were no longer had gone from being compatriots to being foreigners. Right. So they shift to embracing a universal approach, and they collaborated intensely in causes like medical charity, anti-slavery, prison reform, educational charity, and poor relief. And I found that they really remade their relationships as foreigners by embracing a universal approach to philanthropy. And so what you might ask what I mean by universal.
Yeah.
So for most of the 18th century, aid was typically given on the basis of ethnic or religious or occupational or personal ties. So if you weren't part of one of those communities, you could be excluded from aid. And this was a problem in an increasingly mobile world. So in the decades after the American Revolution, Americans and Britons really embraced giving to people without regard to their background, their ethnic or religious background. Although there continue to be charities that give aid on those bases, and those are important, but Americans and Britons really embrace and celebrate the idea of giving based on a shared humanity.
Amanda, what would be an example, say, of the earlier way, right, giving it based on ethnicity or religion or something particular? Could you give us a concrete example of then the shift to universal, you know, how it would be framed in a more universal way? Or are there new organizations that emerge with this universal mission? Can you give us some concrete examples of that transition, taking the sort of abstract into the, you know, maybe organizations we might be familiar with or causes we might be familiar with that were changed as a result of the revolution?
Yes, absolutely. So one example that I've always found really striking was an instance that was written about by a man named Thomas Coram, who was a sea captain not a sea captain, he was called Captain Coram. He had a career in the maritime trades. He was British. He spent 10 years living in Massachusetts and intended always to settle in Massachusetts, in North America, but wound up going back to Britain, where he got involved in founding the Foundling Hospital, which is a well-known hospital for foundlings in mid-18th century London. But he was very active in the world of charity and involved in all sorts of different charitable schemes.
Yeah.
And one thing he wrote about in one of his letters was that he had seen Americans who were in London in the mid-18th century who were in need of charitable aid but weren't eligible. So he suggested to some friends he had back in North America that they should found an organization to aid these Americans who were overseas and in distress. And he said that a model for that could be the Scots Society in Massachusetts. So ethnic Scots in Massachusetts had an organization, a charity, to provide for their brethren in need.
Right.
Well, after the in the midst of the revolution, another British man named John Murray, who had a lot of family in North America and had spent some time in the British Navy traveling in parts of America. He founded a Scots society in the town he lived in Norwich, England. But then over the course of the revolution, he adapted it to being an organization with a universal mission. He called it the Society for Universal Goodwill, and it would help people anywhere in the world, this was the vision,
right,
who were in distress and needed help. It didn't come to pass, but
yeah.
It was too ambitious. But that was sort of what the shift was. Now, an organization that was successful, that had the same kind of impulse, but was more successful than Murray's organization, was organizations called Humane Societies.
Right.
These were charities, nothing to do with animals.
I was going to say,
exactly.
Thanks for clarifying that.
These were charities that promoted the rescue and resuscitation of drowning victims. This was a waterborne world. A lot of people traveled by the water. They were lived by the water. They were just near the water more than we were. And drowning was a concern. And traditionally people didn't rescue or resuscitate drowning victims for various reasons, including that it was dangerous. Most people could not swim. There was also initially some concern about blasphemy. It was God's will that these people drown and you shouldn't intervene. But after overcoming some of those concerns, these organizations promoted the rescue and resuscitation of drowning victims, encouraged people to rescue drowning victims. And they did so embracing the idea that anybody could drown and that we all had an obligation to help them. So while it sounds like sort of a niche cause, it was important in promoting this idea that everybody's life was valuable and everybody could be a rescuer and play a role in saving lives. And I will say that in the United States, African Americans were among the rescued and rescuers. And in both cases, when they were rescued or rescuers, their lives and their actions were valued on par with white Americans. So it was an important way of embracing these new values.
One more question about your work on this. Now I remember when reading parts of your book, you're trying to push the kind of history of American philanthropy and humanitarianism sort of further back into history. Am I right in suggesting that's your kind of contribution here, your contribution to the field in terms of the way you're forcing historians to rethink the history of philanthropy? Because most of it, when I think of philanthropy, right, or the history of giving or history of these kinds of things, it usually kicks in, you know, sometime around, you know, what, the 1830s, 40s, you know, anti-slavery, you know, the reform movements and so forth. But you're suggesting it goes back a lot earlier than this. Yes?
Yes. That's right. Really, the book starts looking at the late 17th century, so the last years of the 1600s. There was a rich world of associationalism in the 18th century, and a lot of this was typically men and elite men, or middling to elite men who were involved. Women don't get involved in organized benevolence until the very end of the 1790s. But Americans were familiar with a world of organized charitable activity. They were part of a transatlantic world of organized charitable activity. I think a lot of historians of philanthropy tend to look at the revolution as a starting point, right, because there is a big outburst of founding organizations after the revolution, and there was new exhilaration and patriotic fervor and new excitement and organizational energy after the revolution, for sure. But a lot of those developments built on practices from before the revolution that Americans were familiar with. And so I look at the revolution as a turning point, not as a starting point.
Sure. Now, I know you mentioned before in the answer to one of your previous questions, Amanda, that you do get some time to continue your work in this field now that you're at the Smithsonian. I remember when we interviewed you on our author's corner on the blog, you told us about a fascinating new project you're working on. Hopefully you will continue to have time to do that. But tell us. You know, what's next for you in terms of the history of philanthropy and your own work?
Right. So I am working on a biography of Isabella Graham. She is one of the few women who features in my first book. She was a Scottish born woman who born in the 1740s, followed her husband, who was a British Army physician, to Canada and then to Antigua, where he died. And she was left with a few children and not much by the way of resources. She went back to Scotland and was active in charitable activity there, and then immigrated in 1789 to New York and spent the rest of her life there. She was one of the leaders of women's involvement in organized benevolence in the early Republic, and really a noted philanthropist who influenced both women's and men's philanthropy and the charitable infrastructure in New York. She's really fascinating to me because her life is similar in some ways to the lives of the men I studied who circulated around the Atlantic world or across to different communities on both sides of the Atlantic. But for a lot of the men I study, many of whom were doctors, the Atlantic was an exhilarating experience. Traveling around was exhilarating and opened all sorts of new opportunities. For Isabella Graham, it left her vulnerable, and I think her charitable innovations are in response to the vulnerabilities she faced as she navigated this mobile world. So that's one thing I'm working on, and then I also get to work on exhibitions here. So one of the things that's terrific for me is I just have a chance to think about American philanthropy from the 17th century to today. So as I mentioned, next year we'll be exploring culture and the arts, and I'm working on an exhibition about cultural and arts-related philanthropy.
So get on out to the, if you're visiting D.C., make sure you stop at the National Museum of American History, learn something about the history of philanthropy.
This really is like a very fascinating conversation because, it's not very often that we as historians get to talk to somebody who knows a whole subfield that you don't even realize is even a subfield.
Yeah.
This is great.
And it must be really thrilling. Now, is this a new position at the Smithsonian that's created, or have they had a curator of philanthropy?
This is a new position. The philanthropy initiative is new. So I belong to a team in the philanthropy initiative. I'm the curator. I have a colleague who's the program manager. And we have, there's an annual half-day, annual half-day symposium. We're looking to add other programming. There's the collecting initiative. And then there's my position and the new exhibition. So yes, this is new. People really haven't paid a lot of attention to the history of philanthropy. So I'm really thrilled to have a chance to talk about it with you and your listeners. Right. And it's one of the things that's really exciting to me is that this is a chance for me to learn so much. And I get everybody I talk to has a story to share. And so it's incredibly, exciting and humbling to hear all American stories about giving.
Excellent, excellent. Our guest today has been Amanda Moniz. She is the David M. Rubenstein Curator of Philanthropy at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. Amanda, thanks so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to join us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
You know, listening to Amanda talk, I'm really encouraged by the leadership of the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. They really seem to be interested in expanding their offerings and expanding the way they explain American history to those who kind of come through their doors. It's a free museum, so they see a lot of people each year. In addition to this new emphasis on the history of philanthropy, I know they've started an American religious history program there under the curator Peter Mansell. So a lot of good things happening at the Smithsonian. If you haven't been there for a while, you might want to get over there soon and see what's going on.
Well, and just in a larger sense, I think we're, maybe this is anecdotal, but I think we're kind of in a golden age of museums or entering one maybe. I'm just seeing a lot of people are talking about museums. I actually just got tickets for the new African American Museum, which of course, you have to get tickets months in advance. A new American Revolution Museum just opened up in Philadelphia, and in a way that is itself a philanthropy, right?
Yeah.
This idea
yeah.
that people are donating large amounts of money for the purpose of education, which I think is encouraging in this moment. We've been talking about that a lot this season.
Yeah, I mean, again, we are in a moment, I think, we have talked about this a lot this season, right? I think it's a moment for history. I think people are starting to see the importance of studying the past and figuring out how we got to the place that we're in right now. And I think museums then can become, I recently read something about museums as a kind of site of resistance, right? As a sort of political site in which one resists the current emperor or the tyrant, right? But you know that you know you could think about them in that politicized way. You could also think about them in a kind of less political way, just contributing knowledge to our democracy, right? Creating informed citizens and so forth, and forcing especially young people to kind of reconnect with our nation's past.
But you know, something that kind of connects a little bit to this to your story that almost gives me maybe an element of concern is the ways in which it seems like there's a lot of money, a lot of investment, a lot of time, a lot of energy going to some very important large museums, but still across our country we know there are small historical sites, yeah. You know, somewhat less well-known, but equally important historical places throughout our country that, you know, are still, I think, really struggling to get money and to keep their doors open.
And this was, I think, the argument we made a few episodes ago when we were talking about the National Endowment for the Humanities and how, you know, do we trust the capitalists? Do we trust the Carnegies of the world, right, to fund, you know, these kind of ordinary museums, or I should say museums that reflect ordinary life, local museums, and so forth. And then, you know, another thing, Drew, is just with philanthropy comes sort of certain ideologies, right? You know, people want to fund things that are going to promote their views of the world. And oftentimes, you know, history does not, when done well, I think doesn't or shouldn't get caught up in some of those sort of ideologies. So, you know, I know there's big kind of evangelical Christians like the Green family who throws a lot of, you know, they built this Museum of the Bible, right? Or I know the Koch brothers, you know, on the right are people who like to fund museums. And, you know, I'm sure there are examples on the left too. So, you know, there's with philanthropy comes that sort of careful dance of, you know, especially for history museums, right? What are you promoting, you know? And in other words, how are you, there's a danger of kind of manipulating the past for some kind of a present day agenda.
Yeah, well, I mean, you mentioned the left or even just the, you know, the revisionist, a lot of casino money coming through Indian reservations is going towards museum curation. And on one hand, for me, especially as someone who works in this field, I'm really happy about that because I think it's a history that's untold. And to see that money being being channeled into museums that help people understand how rich the indigenous past is in this country, I think that's definitely a good thing. That's a great way to use that money in a civically responsible way, a way to help us become more informed citizens, as you often say. But I know, you know, some people who like a much more traditional, unrevised story of the American Revolution have pointed out how the Oneida Nation has given a lot of money to the new American Revolution and the new Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia as a point of critique. Frankly, not one I agree with, but, you know, I mean, that's something at least to bring up.
Go back and look at the blog. There was a piece published by a guy in the conservative Weekly Standard that pretty much trashed the new Philadelphia Museum of the American Revolution, I think very unfairly, for including these diverse voices. It's kind of something you might expect, you know, from a conservative, you know, magazine like the Weekly Standard, but I thought it was a very unfair critique.
Yeah, but of course, us historians who think in hashtag vast early America, we want those stories. Exactly. We want those in the museum. So, I mean, I'm only bringing it up to say that it is a point of debate, and I think it's something that is part of this conversation about museum and philanthropy, museum curation and philanthropy.
Yeah, we need to talk to a lot more museum curators kind of over the years and get these kinds of perspectives from them. Well, Drew, another show in the books. Again, I think this was a good one. So happy to have Amanda Moniz on the show. And hopefully we'll see you down the road somewhere at a museum.
Yeah.
You know, we'll bump into you and talk some history. But in the meantime, may your way of improvement always lead home.
This has been a production of The Way of Improvement Leads Home, a blog dedicated to reflections at the intersection of American history, religion, politics, and academic life. Visit us at thewayofimprovement.com. This episode is brought to you through the generous support of Lisa DeGuardi, Ron Schooler, and our sponsor, Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. If you want to support our efforts, please rate and review us on your podcatcher of choice. so others may more easily find this podcast. The podcast was recorded at the High Center Studios on campus at Messiah College. Thanks to Ed Ark for his continued support. Original music is by Overholt. Many thanks to our guest, Amanda Moniz. Our studio producer is Josh Lowry. I've been your producer, Drew Durley-Hermling, and your host is John Fia.
Thanks to State Farm for supporting this show and helping our listeners protect their businesses and lives. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.